This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York. Today, an interview with Michelle Silver on coping with retirement. Michelle Silver is a professor at the University of Toronto and recently published Retirement and Its Discontents, Why We Won't Stop Working, Even If We Can, with Columbia University Press. My co-host for this episode is Gabriel Rossman of UCLA. This episode was originally broadcast on May 1st, 2019. And now we turn to Michelle Silver from the University of Toronto. Michelle is an expert in gerontology and life course, and she is coming out with a new book, Retirement and Its Discontents, Why We Won't Stop Working, Even If We Can, with Columbia University Press. And Michelle, this is a really interesting topic. You know, on one hand, it's common to see work as like a burden, a yoke around our necks. And, you know, there's a lot of us think of retirement akin to what maybe a prisoner thinks of parole, right? Like we're released from the burden of work. But on the other hand, you know, we know that work is like integral to our identity. And as we age, it becomes like a major venue for meeting people. It gives us a reason to put on clothes in the morning. And so maybe retirement isn't as simple as, you know, the Freedom 55 crowd might be suggesting it is. Can you tell us a little bit about your study, retirement? Like what goes on when people face retirement?
Yes, you raise a number of really great points. I think that most people actually associate retirement with freedom. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I'm looking at a subset of people, people for whom their personal identity was really closely intertwined with the work that they did, with their life's work. And so, you know, when they retired, they found it to be a real letdown. Many of them were looking forward to it and, you know, thought it would be this great time to enjoy the fruits of their labor. And instead, they really struggled to recalibrate their sense of self-worth. And so my book is, you know, a series of studies that I did with different types of people for whom their life's work was the way they defined their personal sense of who they were. So I interviewed doctors, I interviewed CEOs, elite athletes, people who had represented their country in Olympic Games, academics, someone this audience might be able to relate to a bit, and also homemakers. And so they were all, they had this, you know, degree of similarity that I mentioned, but they were also strategically different from one another and strategically different in ways that related to the way we think about the word retirement, some trying to sort of pull on and play with the idea that, you know, like, oh, we don't think of homemakers as being able to retire, and athletes, you know, they retire so young. And you know, the basic idea was to get us to really question the relationship between work identity and age and retirement that we have in society.
Interesting. Can you start us off by telling, like, what happens to people, or at least your subjects, when they retired? So they're, you know, they get the watch, they're looking forward to seeing the grandkids and, you know, watching afternoon baseball or whatever. But what's the reality that confronts your subjects that they find dissatisfying?
So, yeah, so each of the participants that I interviewed, I asked them to, you know, walk me through their career highs and, you know, their trajectory into their life's work, and then their retirement. And it usually, you know, was strategically marked by a party, by a retirement party. And from there, it was different for each person, right? I mean, some of the academics I interviewed were, you know, at their retirement parties and listening to people talk about themselves in ways that sounded like a funeral, and were literally like plotting out the next article that they would write during their retirement party. And you know, and others were, you know, having great experiences afterward, you know, going and having travels and there's that. But most of them, what they talked about was, you know, coming to this point where it was an experience that was a letdown, that was, you know, suddenly they didn't have a way to feel distinguished. They didn't have a sense of fulfillment from their day-to-day activities. And like each one was really quite different in terms of the ways that they experienced discontentment in retirement. And the point is that it's a big contrast to the way that, you know, most media advertisements and billboards that you see really emphasize retirement as this, you know, wonderful time to go have a walk with your partner on the beach and go on cruise ships and spend endless amounts of money.
Yeah. How much does financial insecurity factor into discontent?
Well, I think it depends because, you know, for many, financial insecurity will put them back into the workplace.
Right.
And so then that's a different form of retirement. And that's one of the things that I play around with and reason why I was so interested in studying, why I've made much of my career focused on studying the concept of retirement, is that there are so many different ways to define retirement, to think about what does it mean at the individual and the societal level. But in terms of financial insecurity, I mean, yeah, I'll be the first to say that like everybody should plan financially and should, you know, be aware of the fact that the stock market can take a dive, that your portfolios can change, and that being financially insecure is no fun at any age.
Yeah. But money's not the only challenge that people face. What are the other challenges that people find difficult when they're having a tough time with retirement?
Yeah. So, right. Like if you can put finance and health aside, because those are both two really important issues that will compromise and influence the way a person experiences retirement, the sort of less commonly discussed aspect is the more sort of personal and societal impact of retirement. And that's to say that, for a lot of people, it's an experience of social exclusion. For example, I interviewed CEOs who, you know, every day was scheduled by their three administrative assistants and they just got used to like walking in the door and being in charge and being in demand. And, one of the participants was describing for me the experience of feeling like he talked about it like, you know, longing for his mistress, which he, you know, apparently had some experience with. And he was saying, he was like, you know, to go from being the one in charge to suddenly nobody's calling, nobody needs me, nobody's giving me any attention anymore, was a real sort of slap in the face. And he said to me, it would just be nice just to know that I was still desirable, just to know that, you know, every once in a while, just to get a call to know that I was still in demand. And never mind that he couldn't figure out how in the world to keep his appointments, because suddenly, you know, technology had changed and suddenly like he had to figure out how to keep his, lunch with his buddies. And that was a challenge for him, because he had literally three administrative assistants planning a schedule. That's a very extreme opposite end of financial insecurity example.
You know, it reminds me though, I remember having, my father is in his mid 70s and sometimes I'm interested in well-being as a topic. I remember having a discussion with him because, you know, he's been around for a long time. So I asked him, you know, over the life course, when do you think overall well-being is at its highest? And his answer was kind of interesting. He said, you know, probably around your age. I'm 42 years old. He said, probably in my mid-40s. And he goes, you know, at that time, you got the kids hanging off you and the job is a hassle and you think that, you know, you're just overburdened. But what you don't realize is that you're overburdened because you're so central to so many different people. And he says, as you age, you get pushed to the periphery and you realize that all those demands on your time were in fact an embarrassment of riches. And that part of the problem is dealing with marginalization. It's much worse to have nobody care about your opinion than to have people clamoring for it.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I think that there's a lot to that. I'd love to like hear more of advice from your dad. I think that's pretty awesome. I mean, I think that's true. And I think so much of, we don't think about age, about the marginalization that is associated with aging that much. But it is, you know, something that if we're lucky enough, all of us will experience, right? Like if we don't die young, we all will age. And sure, to say that, you know, being busy, the busy ethic, that that is what, you know, keeps us happy is really interesting. You know, there's a lot of different ways to think about that. I guess in terms of the, like, when we're most happy in the life course, I can't help but think about Laura Carstensen's work and socioselectivity theory, and just how, like, when our time horizons are shrinking, that we sort of optimize behaviors and think about more positive things, or that those become more important to us. And so, you know, along with that, there's been a bit of research suggesting that in later adulthood, we're happier, you know, closer to your dad's age is supposed to be the more happy time, right? You don't have all those demands. But I definitely think that for a subsector, for people who did really well on the marshmallow test, right? People who are really good at delaying gratification and are overachievers, and who've, you know, constantly been trying to move up the career ladder and have really, you know, given into letting their work dominate all other spheres of life. You know, like Kozer would say, you know, have given into the greedy institutions. I think that for those of us who've done that, or are in those kinds of jobs, retirement can be, a real time of marginalization. Most of our adulthoods have been characterized by and dominated by work. And when work lets you go, whether it's because, you know, you receive the signals that you're no longer productive or deemed to be important enough, and, you know, sort of scooched towards out the door, then it can be a really harsh adjustment.
So I'm wondering how much of this, you know, so there's potential confounders, right? Because most of us retire when we're in our late 60s or early 70s, typically late 60s. And so there's obviously a big change in time use and meaning and everything like that. But there's also just the simple fact of aging. And so I was really interested to hear that you used athletes, right, who retire much younger. Now, they in some ways can age faster than some of the rest of us, particularly if they did a contact sport. You know, if you've ever seen a retired football player walk, it's not pleasant looking.
Right.
But, you know, but for the most part, they're still young when they retire, middle-aged when they retire, right? Almost all of them retire younger than I am. So how does that kind of give you a almost natural experiment to unpack, you know, here's people who have a lot of meaning associated with their career, but they retire from their main job, at least, extremely young.
I mean, they by definition, they retire when their bodies are no longer able to perform at their peak ability. And so, and that, you know, is early in the life course. And I included them intentionally to play around with the idea that retirement is in the time frame that you described, right? That and that was intentional because I want to make the point that if people associate retirement with a specific chronological age, or if we as a society do that, then we're really losing out on a lot of potential potential contributions to society, and that individuals often will just, you know, get to that point, like 65, you know, Canada was Freedom 55, as Joe was citing, lots of people remember those ads. US more, it's more like 65. And that I think can be problematic in the sense that there is really nothing predictive of your age, I think, in adulthood, beyond telling you when your next birthday is going to take place. So the athletes, you know, were there to introduce that and to also, you know, through their stories, they sort of made the point that, that it was challenging, that making the transition to doing other kind of work, was difficult. Like, you know, some of the athletes I interviewed went on and made a lot of money, had very demanding, high pressure careers, but they would tell me how nothing they ever did would measure up to the adrenaline rush that they got from competing,
right,
and you know, and being in demand the way that they were for what they considered to be their life's work. And the transitions that they made to other kinds of professions, jobs, what have you, you know, there was the whole range. I mean, athletes are quite interesting in that way, because some of them, you know, doesn't, being an athlete or an elite athlete doesn't necessarily predict what kind of work you're going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of them go into coaching, but in any event, you know, the point was to say that the transitions that they experienced were sort of telling. Like, we often in gerontology will look to older adults and try to use their experiences to apply to earlier parts of the life course. And here was this, you know, really young group of people, but describing things that were akin to the ways that people later in adulthood described.
Interesting.
So I wonder if what the findings would be like if you had professional dancers who as a rule retired around 24,
mm-hmm.
which is even younger than athletes, I imagine. And it's, you can imagine it being so young
mm-hmm.
that, you know, they have to have another career
mm-hmm.
After that. And, you know, maybe in their case, they derive meaning from that new career. But, you know, I it wouldn't surprise me if they're basically the same as other people who put intense physical demands on their body, like athletes.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I one of the participant whose story shared in the book was a gymnast. And, you know, and so she retired by 21. And, you know, and the challenge and sort of contrast to what you just suggested is that, you know, she had spent her entire childhood focused on her gymnastics.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, she had like pretty much moved away from her parents by early childhood and, you know, never to go back and live with them again. And so by the time she retired and, you know, she did very well medaling, et cetera. But she didn't have a plan B because mm-hmm. it took everything. It took all aspects of her being to be able to focus on her routine, which she practiced 6 days a week for mm-hmm. at least 8 hours a day, if she got the routine right, for, you know, something like 15 years or more than that. I mean, around that amount of time, right? Which is the equivalent of a career. And so, you know, while it is true she did have youth, she found the transition to be really challenging in a number of different ways. And one of those was the idea that, you know, she was no longer important for the reasons that she had been for most of her life. And, you know, so she said she would meet people and they would say, "Hey, what are you doing now?" And, you know, and just remember, she was like in her, she was 21 when I interviewed her, and she said, people would say, "What are you doing now?" And she would say, you know, I'm still important, you know, I'm still who I am, but mm-hmm. I can't say that I'm a gymnast anymore. And because of that, she just felt it really caused her to have to do a double take on who she was as a person.
Mm-hmm. Is it the loss of personal purpose or the loss of a mission, or is it the loss of social esteem, or is it both that bother those who retire at any age?
I think that, you know, when you are somebody who gives 110% to your work, mm-hmm. so, you know, for example, many physicians are, you know, acculturated through the institution of medicine to prioritize their work over everything else that they do, right? They're woken up in the middle of the night when they're on call, and they're immediately expected to jump into this role, which quite often does involve life or death decisions. I mean, obviously, depending on the type of medicine that you practice,
mm-hmm.
but it can, right? Like, unlike us, right? Like, we don't make life or death decisions, right? Thank goodness.
Like a sociology emergency.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, but nonetheless, you can kind of relate. I mean, the tenure process,
yeah.
going through the process of tenure, like, it really forces you to focus in on work and to prioritize it. Because if you can't, there's a million other people who will, right?
Yeah, totally.
Who will do that. So I think that for people like that, like I said, people who do well on the marshmallow test and, you know, can delay gratification and prioritize their work, that when they come to the end of the tunnel, it can be really hard to remember oh yeah, there's a marshmallow. Oh yeah, I get to eat that marshmallow. Oh yeah, I forget what it even tastes like. And it may not taste that good as you remembered it.
Yeah.
If you don't, I'm not saying all academic, I'm not saying everybody is going to be this way. I mean, this is, you know, again, like I'm really careful in the book to include a big methodological appendix and to explain that like this sentiment is really not meant to be generalizable. Mm-hmm. I just think it's really interesting.
we're kind of looping in a way back to the Chase segment where yeah. You know, the overall theme of this week's string of episodes is eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we shall die. Also because, or rather, eat, drink, and be merry because, you know, you're not going to be able to afford a mortgage anyway.
One of the two. But it's also interesting because, you know, those parallels, you have me thinking about, you know, those who have difficulty making the leap from a doctoral program to a long-term academic job. And people are like, well, why don't you just get a job in industry? But it's kind of a similar thing, right? If somebody goes to get their doctorate, they spent like probably a decade orienting their identity and their conception of their self as an academic. And for somebody to be so flip and be like, well, just go work for a marketing company or an HR outfit, it's probably not as easy as that advice would presume.
Yeah, I've always wondered, like, I've always had a similar thought of, like, you know, there's kind of a puzzle of why the labor supply is so big for adjuncts.
Yeah.
And in one sense, the reason it's so big is obvious. It's because we produce too many PhDs relative to the size of the assistant professor lines. But, you know, but that doesn't completely solve the question, because then it implies, like, why don't people quit?
Yeah, totally.
You know, and I think, like you're saying, it's basically because you spend, you know, 4 to 10 years in graduate school, basically having your habitus shaped to the extent that you can't imagine doing anything else.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a disability. I went through graduate school the entire time thinking I could possibly end up a business consultant, and I was fine with it. And it totally was great because I think it preserved my mental health in some way. But that's getting off topic. What about Michelle? Those who do retire well, what do they do?
I think they do what you just described. You know, I think you're going to be just fine.
Thank you.
And I mean, I think, you know, being open to having a plan B is like a great, you know, throughout your life, is a great way, I think, to ameliorate the transition if you end up in the line of work that is in a greedy institution that demands everything of you. If you can always kind of keep in the back of your mind, like, you know, I can do other things. I do have other aspects of myself. And, you know, I think that the trick is, just like you were both just saying, that people kind of get stuck. They get stuck in the, you know, idea that there is only one way to contribute to society, you know, and that is, you know, in whatever subfield that they're in, or they get stuck in terms of being unable to be marketable in different types of jobs, right? And I mean, those are big issues. But, you know, I mean, nowadays, like we can work anytime, anywhere. Most people, I mean, not everybody, but that can kind of bring on the omnipresence of work, and if you kind of buy into that, it can make separating other aspects of your life really difficult. And so the extent to which it's possible to have other interests, other aspects of yourself, I think those people, you know, the people that I interviewed who were able to be more well-rounded or, you know, to get enjoyment from aspects of their life that were not only the one that they were also being paid for,
right?
That behooved them. I mean, you know, because we all have this fantasy that, like, I'm doing the thing that makes me most happy, that I would do this for free, that, you know, I love what I'm doing, and you know, that I think that can be fine. I think it, you know, so long as you work till you die, and part of my point is to say that why shouldn't, you know, for lots of types of work, you should be able to work till you die. Like, there's so much intergenerational tensions. And I've written a couple of papers, not in the book, but other work that speaks to that idea, that there's this idea that older workers and younger workers are, that we're substitutes for each other. And I think that's really complicated. That really complicates things. You know, I hear from colleagues will say, you know, what about the colleague who like really should retire, that we can't wait for them to retire? And you know, and I just think about the other end of the spectrum, that, you know, there's also individuals that we take huge risks on when they're early in their career and who make all sorts of mistakes. And yet we don't, you know, we don't necessarily, you know, we let them prove themselves. And so as a society, and that's, you know, part of the argument here is to say that as a society, we really ought to give pause to this idea that a chronological age should dictate when people stop making contributions.
Mm-hmm. Do they still have mandatory retirement in the Canadian Academy, or did they get rid of that?
No, it's pretty well gotten rid of. There's few exceptions, you know, airline pilots, you know, the numbers of occupations where there's still mandatory retirement is not so common now. But you know, I've interviewed people who you know, experienced mandatory retirement, in academic institutions and otherwise. And, you know, on the one hand, what's interesting, you know, on the one hand, it's not helpful at all to be pushed or forced into anything. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, then there was the planning aspect of it, where they could give themselves time to think about what was going to happen next, because they had no choice about it.
Right.
No choice except for to do that, because that was the rule. It was mandatory. And I think that's sort of interesting, because the way it is now, there are these financial incentives, but it's not a rule. But then we're finding a lot of people opting into it, and then we're sort of losing out on potential contributions. Mm-hmm. And anyway, and for the sake of pension systems, it gets really complicated the way we it right now.
There's an intro. I don't want to. This will be the second and last time I quote my father on this. It's just we've talked about this so often, and he could have very well been one of your subjects as a doctor. But I remember him also telling me something along the lines of, I was asking why he didn't retire, and he goes, so he says, listen, son, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to have a meal, I'm going to read the New York Times, I'm going to walk around the block, and now it's 8:45 in the morning. What am I going to do between now and when I go to bed? How much of it is just the difficulty of filling a day? How many people do you see just have trouble finding something to do, anything to do?
Yeah. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people said to me, when every day becomes a weekend, mm-hmm. You know, when it becomes interchangeable and between a weekday and a weekend, it can be a quite discontentful experience, you know, however you want to say the word. It's not, it's really tricky, right? And, you know, on the other hand, like there are lots of people for whom every day is an autonomous experience, and planning out what they're going to do. You know, I can think of people in the creative professions and in academia alike where, you know, it's like, I know how to plan a day, and, right. And like academics, we plan out whole semesters, right? Like we're quite good at thinking through, scheduling. And so I would say that, you know, it's not just about that. It's also about, being important and connecting with other people. It's not just about, you know, I don't know how to schedule my day. Cause I'm quite sure, like if your dad was hard pressed, he would be able to find lots of interesting things, right? Lots of retirement seminars will propose, you know, continuing education. And like I myself have like a whole list, you know, when I get asked to give talks, I have a whole list of strategies and ways that one can fill their day. But I just think it's really important to also acknowledge that that when society associates age with productivity or creativity or contribution, mm-hmm. period, it's really tricky when you reach that age and people just assume that you're no longer
useful,
going to be able to contribute. Yeah, useful.
Yeah. I have only one more question. Over the process of watching people, you know, cope with, you know, the end of their work life, have you developed any opinions about, you know, how much of life is, you know, you talk about the marshmallow test a lot, and how when they ultimately get the marshmallow, it's not as tasty. And sometimes the goals we set are just motivators, or they give us a rationale to put our pants on in the morning and pursue something. It's the pursuit that matters. Do you see evidence of that? Like, is it that, you know, one of the challenges you reach at the end of life is you don't have sort of these long-term goals to work towards, and that causes problems? I've always wondered that.
I think it's always helpful to have goals at either point, you know, at any point early in the life course. And I think it's just as important later in the life course. I mean, it's funny because I don't even mention the marshmallow test in my book. I think I might be hungry or something. Because like I keep thinking of like analogies, which I didn't make there. But, you know, I started to think about retirement kind of like the banana just today. And I think I read something recently about how, you know, bananas – they're about to go extinct, right? That we're not,
I didn't know
the bananas that we know of. What is it? The Cavendish banana is the one that like dominates now.
And the older banana already went extinct in the 1960s.
No way.
So the Gros Michel banana that was popular in the early 20th century went extinct around 1960, and then took them a few years to develop the Cavendish. Yeah. And it's going to go extinct soon.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. I mean, I think, like, it's like retirement, where it seems like this really boring topic that, like, what? Like, it's so common and ordinary, and you hear about it all the time. But then when I learned all this about the bananas, which is just, I realized there's quite a bit of overlap. Like, both of them were kind of rare before the late 19th century. And they're both kind of like, when they came into being, they were initially these kind of exotic objects / concepts, and, you know, reserved for like a small segment of the population that could afford them, or that were, you know, given access to them. And now they're like everywhere. And, you know, they both like, you know, bananas that come in this nice packaging, right? They're like a really health oriented type of thing, and retirement is too. Like, there's these nice retirement packages people have, and then the thing is that when I heard about the idea that the banana is about to become, there's this fungus, right, that's about to make them no longer what they are, which is like the fourth most important crop that we have. It made me think about how, you know, our understanding of retirement is something that it really is changing, and likely it needs to change. We're living longer than we ever have in all of human history. And because of that, we have this sort of term that's become a bit anachronistic, that's become associated with age. And yet the age that people retire, you know, is not keeping up with life expectancy. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, I plot out in my book, you know, the gap that has emerged between average retirement age in many parts of the world, and how, and our life expectancy, which has just gone up and up and up. And with that comes, I think, a real need to rethink what retirement is and what we want it to be.
You've been listening to The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. You can visit our show site at sociocast.org/annex. We are on Twitter at SociAnnex, and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. Music by Lena Orsa. I'm Joseph Cohen. Thank you for listening.